Good morning, everybody. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's Wednesday, March 6, 2019. I'd like to remind everybody to kind of mute their cell phones if they could. We've been very good about it this year, and it's certainly appreciated. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Michicki, Senator Hoffman, Senator Wilkowski. A couple other senators will be coming late. We have a health fair going on, so they're getting their blood pressure and blood drawn. Make sure everybody has blood at the table. Kind of doesn't run too hot. Anyway, also with us today, we have Senate President Giesel, Majority Leader Costello, and Senator Stevens. And we're going to continue the multiple hearings we're having on the budget that's presented to us. We've spent some time at the committee here laying out the overview of it and then going through high-level review of each department. Now, we are now today going to have two presentations from some economists talking about the impacts of the potential budget and the status of the state. Later on in the next few weeks, we'll have probably in less than 2 weeks, we'll have the Department of Revenue before us looking at the spring forecast for oil prices, and we'll have a review of the order of operations of our tax calculations on dealing with our oil basin. This will not be a discussion of a policy discussion on any particular item within it, if it's good or bad or otherwise, but just the mechanics of how it works, or what it looked like the last 3 years, what it appears to look like, what's coming at us the next 2 to 3 years, because this is not a one-year fix on this budget issue that we're working with today. So that'll put kind of the revenue in a finer view. And then we're going to bring in some of the major departments that are expecting substantial changes within them. And that'll include Department of Education, Department of DOT, dealing with all our transportation, airports, including Marine Highway and roads. And then we'll have Health and Social Services, an in-depth discussion on that at the table when the subcommittee chairman is a little further along in her review because of the complexities of that department. So that's kind of what's coming at us over the next few weeks, and then eventually we'll be having the subcommittee chairmans bring forward their recommendations. But we have some more work to do to set the stage and make sure the committee has a broadest understanding of the issues that we face. So today, we're going to have two presentations. The first one will be from the Department of Labor, and the second one's going to be from the Office of Management and Budget. So we're going to start with the Department of Labor with Dan Robinson. He's the Chief of Research and Analysis, and if he can come forward, identify himself for the record and take us through his presentation. We'll continue to let him finish a slide, and then we may ask questions. If there is, I'll stop for questions. I would like both presenters today and the Lifeline support people that are here to help them if there's a particular question to remember the audience isn't necessarily the committee members and the other senators in the room. It's the fellow Alaskans around the state that will be watching this meeting. So we want to try to stay away from as much jargon as possible and be careful with acronyms and not forget to define some of the terminology that's being used, and also the relevancy of the information, why we should even care about it. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and ask Mr. Robinson to introduce himself for the record and speak to the Alaskan people about his presentation.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. For the record, my name is Dan Robinson. I'm the research chief at the Research Analysis Section of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. By way of introduction of the research and analysis section a little bit, we spend the bulk of our time and energy producing a lot of the economic data that you're familiar with, jobs, wages, unemployment rates, population numbers. We do that, for the most part, with federal partners, primarily the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, also the U.S. Census Bureau. We're non-partisan. We're policy neutral, sometimes by federal contract. For example, when we release our monthly unemployment rate jobs press release, even the timing of that is specific. So if a new governor says, I don't want that bad news Friday, we have to say by contract, we release this data. So that's important for understanding where we come from, the perspective we bring. I put up three of our most recent issues of Alaska economic trends. I mentioned for the most part we produce the data. This is our primary vehicle for disseminating the analyses we do of the data. We do an annual job forecast, for example. We write about different areas of the state. We sometimes do little more in these articles than show some of the data. We do an annual cost of living article, for example, that's not terribly analytical, but it's all of the data we can find on the cost of living in Alaska, an important topic that we know from years of doing it. There's a lot of interest in. Most of what I'm going to talk about today is macroeconomic at the state level. And when I say macroeconomic, I mean that's the economy as a whole. Microeconomic would be individuals, and we tend to stories of individuals resonate more with us. And as we, with one exception, all of my slides today are statewide data. That doesn't mean there aren't important regional differences. Alaska quite often has 4 or 5 of the top 10 unemployment rates in the nation at the county level, borough census area. So there are important details underneath the state level data, but that's not our focus today. Again, with one exception. So jumping right into the first slide, to give a sense of scale, first for some orientation, the blue line here shows natural increase. That's just simply births minus deaths. And you can see this is our post-World War II history. So we go way back. World War II is its own fascinating history in terms of what created the Alaska that we all live in, our infrastructure. A lot of important things came specifically because of World War II. But you see three themes in this. You see the importance of the military. And let me just finish with the orientation part. The blue line's natural increase. The orange lines are net migration. So that's the number of people who moved to Alaska minus the number of people who moved out. So for example, the bar that's labeled Korean War, that means 26,000 or so more people moved to Alaska than moved out. Doesn't mean 26,000 people came here. That's the net number. So that anything above that zero line means population growth. And so what you can see, looking at this kind of broadly, is the importance of the military to Alaska's population history, and population and economics and jobs move together. And then you get into the 70s era, and you very clearly see the importance of oil and gas in our state's history. Very large migration flows, specific, more in than out, but also some outs related to what's happening with our oil and gas industries. And then in the more recent period, you see the third theme, which is the relationship we have between the U.S. economy. When the U.S. economy is doing one thing and Alaska is doing the other, then that affects our migration flows. That affects the health of our economy. It magnifies a little bit some of those some of the things that are happening in the two economies. And I'll move on, Chair Seven. Okay. So first question, and one more point I wanted to make, just as a broad point. With a few exceptions, almost all of what we do is current and historical. We hope the patterns from that are useful to you as you wrestle with your policy questions. But we don't do a lot of the economic impact of fill in the blank. That's a different kind of work. That's work that I think is going to be discussed by people who come after me. So with a few exceptions, don't look to me to tell you what's going to happen. But what is happening, do look to us. And this is what is happening and what has been happening. We've been losing jobs for 39 months and counting. You can see that early on 2016, the losses were at their worst. there were lots of announcements of oil and gas layoffs. That quickly becomes fewer jobs in professional and business services. That's the engineers, the geologists. That quickly becomes fewer jobs in construction. That not so quickly becomes fewer jobs in state government. Those are the four biggest sectors in terms of numerical job losses. So this is the one exception that I mentioned where we look at some data other than statewide. This highlights that not every part of the state has experienced the job loss to the same magnitude. If it's red or pinkish, then that's loss. If it's blue, it's job gains. One important point here is that this is employment by place of work, so that North Slope loss of 4,200 jobs over this period, and sometimes you hear numbers, people arguing about numbers when really all they're arguing about is the time period. So if you've heard 5,000 plus oil and gas jobs, that's true for this specific period that I used for the data available, 4,200. But those workers are, of course, scattered throughout the state, particularly in Fairbanks, Anchorage, Matsu, less so in Southeast, Kenai Peninsula, of course. So the loss of jobs on the North Slope affect the economies of everywhere those workers live. If you do see a few parts of the state, Matsu is the clearest exception, where there has been job growth over this period. Matsu had only a very brief period of job loss during this current recession. If you're at all like me, you look at that and think, what kind of jobs? Remember, those are jobs that exist in Matsu. A lot of Matsu workers also commute to Anchorage. But the answer to where those 750 jobs came from in Matsu, 450 of them were healthcare, 150 of them were local government. So that was interesting to me partly, and I wanted to mention it, because population growth, which Matsu also has, creates growth in, every time, healthcare, local government. Population growth creates needs for the population. I'll move on to the next slide.
We have joined by Senator Wilson, Senator Birch, and we have a question from Senator Machicki.
No, actually, Mr. Robinson, right? And why only the first three quarters? I'm sure there's a reason for that metric.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, thanks for asking. That was the most current data we had for 2018, and to make the comparisons consistent and to basically cover the time period of our current downturn.
Thank you.
So another important theme in terms of what's happening and what's been happening recently is that we've had, for the first time in our history, six consecutive years of net migration losses. That's what I've circled here. That adds up to about 35,000 net loss to our economy. Be careful not to assume that means total population loss, because underneath this is natural increase. Only in the last 2 years has our population actually declined, and by a total of less than 4,000. So our population, despite this, remarkably stable. But as I mentioned, six consecutive years, never happened before for Alaska. This gets our attention and starts to raise additional questions about what's going on, why. Another important point here, you see that our migration flows are very large, the largest among any state, going clear back to the early 90s. So we have predictably from what you can see, 35 to 50,000 people moving to Alaska and moving out of Alaska. We have strong pull, and we have strong push. The pull is lots of things, including the beauty of Alaska, the adventure of Alaska, the opportunity. The pull is the weather and whatever else drives people. The military is a factor here too. The net losses, the total losses, aren't particularly big relative to the 1980s. We lost more people in a shorter time. But again, the point here is it's 6 years, and we're looking at that closely, paying attention to when it turns around.
Senator Bishop.
I'm good now. Thank you.
So the, did you parse out the resident and non-resident? On your previous slide, you had some job impacts on the North Slope. There's a fairly significant amount of population that works up there that are not residents, so how did you deal with that?
Chair Stedman, these are residents, on this chart, residents by the census definition, so that means these are people who when they were counted, which is July 1st, this was their one home. To answer your question about non-residents on the North Slope, Alaska, in recent years, it's had about between 35% and 40% of the north of the oil and gas industry are non-residents. That percentage dropped from 37% in 2016 to about 33% when the job losses started happening. So, specific to this chart, there's nothing non-resident in this. They're all residents. An important thing to keep in mind when we do our research on non-resident workers, that uses the permanent fund dividend definition of residency, which requires a full calendar year of presence in the state. That's a rigorous definition of residency. So the question's a good one for keeping track of when we're talking about residency by the census definition and when we're talking about non-resident workers and using that more rigorous definition of you have to be here for an extended period of time before you're eligible for a dividend.
So on the previous slide, slide 5, on the North Slope, there's 4,248 people?
4,248 jobs.
Jobs.
Correct.
And some of those jobs could be non-residents?
Absolutely. In fact, that's the percentage, well, the percentage of workers, which is slightly different, but for our purposes here, the same. About a third, slightly more than a third of those jobs would have been held by non-residents.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
Back to the previous slide. Do you, so I hear what you're saying on out-migration. I'm assuming it's the same metric. These are folks that would fulfill the definition of a resident by the permanent fund, being eligible for the permanent fund dividend. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, no, this would be using the census definition of residency, which is this is where they say at the time of counting that their primary place of residence is. So if for example, a seafood processing worker came here and kept their home wherever they came from, they're not being counted here. On the other hand, if an oil and gas worker came here and said, this is my, or a military person, this is my home as of now, I have no other home, they are counted.
Brief follow-up?
Yes.
Does the department have any idea who is leaving Alaska? Is that data that you've collected?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, yes, to a degree. So specific to oil and gas, for example, we can identify the people who were working in the oil and gas industry in 2015, which was the peak year, and then look in 2016 and 2017 to see if one, they're still in Alaska. Did they apply for a permanent fund dividend? Two, are they working in Alaska? Some of them may have retired. And that research shows, and it's preliminary because this is kind of happening still, that a surprisingly high number of people who were working in the oil and gas industry and aren't any longer are still in Alaska. Some of them are working in other jobs. Some of them are here not working. But about 10% of all, this was 2015-2017, actually left the state.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
So another point I wanted to make is that over this period, Alaska has underperformed the nation and every other state. You see us down there at the far right of this graph. Another thing to notice is who's down there with us, North Dakota and Wyoming, and even Louisiana, especially North Dakota and Wyoming, have something very obvious in common with us. They depend heavily on oil, natural resources. They also have small populations. So there's not a lot of mystery of what's driving this this ranking during this period. So, and I've kind of given away it's a cliffhanger, what's been the problem? Well, oil is part of it, obviously, and I'm not, that's not a breaking news for anybody in this room or anybody who's been paying attention at all. But it's not, you know, is it all about oil? It becomes an interesting question. Looking at those two states that are down there where we are, at the far right of the graph, Wyoming and North Dakota both had oil-related employment losses over a very similar period, different shape, depth of recession. The primary point I wanted to make here is that both of those states are now growing, and growing at 2% for North Dakota and 3% for Wyoming. So they've absorbed the oil shock, and their growth has resumed. Anytime you make comparisons to other states, you need to think hard about how valid that comparison is. Their oil industries are very different than our oil industry. Shale, it comes and goes faster. North Dakota's oil industry exploded, as a lot of you know, in the 2010 forward era. That was shale. That it came fast and it went fast when prices went down. Our oil industry, by employment, doesn't move as fast. But what we believe is keeping us from growth more so than anything else is that and we talked about this in 2016. When this oil price plunge came, it looked pretty clear that that was going to precipitate this need for a structural change in how Alaska finances its state government, how much state government, what happens with the permanent fund and the permanent fund dividend, whether we have to have taxes. Those are hard questions. Those look like they were going to have to be sorted out. That, we believe, is most likely what you hear a lot of weasel words when I say that, because there are other possible explanations. But I feel fairly confident, we feel fairly confident, that that's why we haven't started to grow yet. Absent that issue, our fundamentals are such that we would probably be growing again, almost certainly be growing again.
Before you go on to the next slide, back on slide 9, Wyoming's coal state and the economics and that market's substantially different than North Dakota that deals with shale oil, or Alaska that can deal with conventional oil. So why would you pick a coal state like Wyoming?
Sheriff Sedman, they're a coal state and an oil state. They're a natural resources state. But both of those things, you're right, both of those things took a hit over this period. Coal has come back less strongly, but Wyoming does still. And Wyoming has a lot. They have their own much smaller permanent fund from oil revenue. So oil. Wyoming is, and we could talk about this and look at the numbers if you'd like. But very much an oil and a coal state. North Dakota is very much an oil state and an agricultural state. There are other factors that drive both of those economies, but they do pump meaningful oil. Oil plays a big role in their economies.
Do they have the same structure with ownership in their state that we have?
Chair Sedman, that's one of the key questions, right? They don't. They have, and North Dakota is interesting because we look at personal, so let me first answer that question. No, they don't. They have much less federal and state government land ownership. To that point, North Dakota is interesting. We look at personal income when we make these comparisons. And North Dakota's personal income that came from a category called dividends, interest, and rent grew substantially, the percentage of it, from 2007 to 2017. What that means, there was a lot of income generated from leasing of those private property oil and gas. And that's an income stream that's not available in Alaska. That's an important point.
And to put a finer point on that, isn't it that Alaska is the only state that owns a subsurface, generally speaking, or Texas and North Dakota, the subsurface is owned by the farmers or the ranchers, and in this case, North Dakota's dividend income that you referenced would be the shale gas leases?
Sheriff Sedman, that's correct. Yep. And that goes to the point of how different it is. So it's important to identify them as states that have economies where oil plays an important part. But and every single time you make a state comparison, there will be important differences. This is a particularly big difference between Alaska and any other oil state.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
To reinforce the point that there's something going on here besides a simple oil shock, this is a graph that shows the shape of our 1980s recession compared to the shape of our current recession. And a couple of points I'll make here. One, going into the recession, we were growing, as many of you around the table know, very strongly in the early 1980s. We weren't growing very strongly in 2012, 13, 14, before we went into the current recession. The recession was much deeper. It had much more impact on Alaska individuals and households because of its impact on the housing market. As I mentioned, more people left the state. It was a bigger deal to individual Alaskans by far. And then it ended sooner. We roared out of it, and the late 80s we had fairly strong growth. So again, to reinforce the point, there's something going on here besides an oil shock. At the early stages of the when it was fairly clear that we were going into this recession, this period of economic job loss precipitated by oil, we thought we'd take a hard look at how long recessions last in other states, and whether they shared common causes. And what we found that's relevant here today is that 75% of the time recessions last 2 years or less. Another 20%, they last 3 years or less. We're now in this category where 93% of the time a recession, a period of job loss, would have ended by now. So the important point is, why do they linger when they linger? So one example is in Oregon in the early 1980s. They were shedding a timber industry, a very large and important historical industry to their state. So it's not even really a recession at that point. It's a structural change. It's a permanent subtraction from the economy. In Southeast, we went through this with the timber industry. The loss of pulp mills in Sitka and Ketchikan. Those aren't recessions. Those are permanent changes to an economy. They don't last forever. Something else inevitably picks up and job growth resumes. But as you can see, the much more typical pattern is for something to precipitate a period of job loss, the economy absorbs the impact, growth resumes. Again, 75% of the time in 2 years or less. And this is part of that same study from 1961 to 2016. 90% of the time, Alaska's economy was growing. For the nation, 82% of the economy. And when I say the economy, I want to be a little more precise. Those states were adding jobs. That's one and probably the most commonly used and understood metric for the overall health of an economy. So this was through 2016. If you add our 40 months or so of job losses now, that percentage changes a little, but not a lot. We go down to 84%. And the point I wanted to make here is that the default state, the status quo, the normal state of an economy is growth. Sometimes we think that normal is zero, and if we're growing, we understand why. If we're shrinking, we understand why. That's not so much the case. The normal state of an economy is growth. Population growth drives employment growth, and a lot of times you can't specifically say why an economy is growing. When an economy is not growing, you can almost always specifically say why it's not growing. And this is summing up basically what I've said so far. That I guess I haven't said very much about uncertainty. That need to take care of this structural problem and the messiness of it politically, that's created uncertainty in our economy. Others more than us have talked about uncertainty. Musinga Tabi from the university's Institute of Social and Economic Research has attempted to quantify that, a very hard task. but he's come up with some results that from $200 to $600 million a year of private capital spending doesn't happen because there's uncertainty, there are questions. If you're a business, if you're an individual, this unsolved problem has you sit on your wallet a little bit. And we shouldn't exaggerate the degree that happens. We'll talk about that in a minute. Lots of things are happening in our economy that aren't particularly affected by a lot of the things we're wrestling with. And then the other part of that is that there have been some economic costs that we've already absorbed related to the recession. So less spending, lower dividends, actual subtractions from our economy of money that we had gotten used to going into our economy, all really going back to declines in oil revenue.
Before you go on to that slide, Senator Von Imhoff has a question.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So based on this first bullet point, to what degree would you comment that this is self-inflicted versus external forces beyond our control?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I'm going to change the question just a little bit with your permission, and rather than self-inflicted within our control. And thank you for the question, because that's one of the points we've tried to make in our articles, that typically Alaska's recession is driven by things outside of our control, oil prices being the most obvious one, fish prices, mineral prices, what the international cruise industry decides to do for Alaska. But this one is very much within our control. So that's important in terms of I guess, creating urgency to take care of it.
And then if you could help me with a definition that you use for recession. I know you have a lot of static and data analysis, and sometimes you have things that may look like something of significance when it's just an anomaly. So how do you define a recession in length of terms? And is it a one-quarter dip or a six-month dip or a two-year dip?
Chair Stedman, that's a good question. We had the same question when we were being asked in 2016, are we in a recession? What do you mean? What's a recession? There is no formal definition of a state-level recession. Some economists argue there's no such thing as a state-level recession because recessions are broader than that. I have a California colleague who argues he's wrong, I'm right. But so the way we defined it, and it was a proposed definition, was at least three-quarters of over-the-year employment losses. So three quarters were important to us because imagine what could happen if we only used two quarters. We could have an especially good fishing year, for example, a good summer. That's not a recession. Three quarters brings in the off-season, Alaska's off-season. During the 2009-10 period, it was only three quarters. That qualified by that measure. So and broadly, it's a sustained period. To your question, briefly dropping below because of a bad fishing season, because of an earthquake, so those aren't recessions. It's something that's more lasting, more lengthy.
So if you use a three-quarter measurement period, what does the federal government use when they define a national recession, and why is there a definitional difference?
Chair Stedman, I'm glad you asked. I didn't want to volunteer it because I wasn't sure how much interest there would be. There's an organization called the National Bureau of Economic Research that nobody appointed them, but they've become the accepted recession dating. They have a recession dating committee, and they look at all of the economic data. Mostly in recent years, mostly employment, but they also look at gross domestic product, and they date the beginning and ending of recessions. And they'll write. It's a little bit like the Federal Reserve. They'll write long explanations for why they chose this period and not that period. And another important point there is they don't specify the end date of a recession quite often for 9 months, 10 months, a year. So you'll know, for example, in December that the recession ended in February of the previous year. There's some similarities there. We don't know yet whether we're growing or not. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some metrics that suggest we are. But we'll know with some certainty down the road a little ways. Short answer to your question, National Bureau of Economic Research, it's a mix of economic metrics they look at.
So it's the same measurement periods that you use?
They,
or is it different?
It's not. So they would just they would look at what the direction of the various metrics. So when the economy stops expanding, and there's obviously some subjectivity there. So gross domestic product is one metric, employment growth is another metric. But when the economy as a whole, with some important definitional squishiness there, stops growing, they say that's when the recession started. When the economy starts growing again, that's when the recession ended. A lot of subjectivity, a lot of art beneath the science. What you often hear is that a recession is 2 quarters of GDP decline. That's kind of a textbook definition, but there's no, that's not the one that's used by the accepted authority on dating recessions nationally. There is no such entity at the state level.
Okay, go ahead and continue and let the record reflect that Senator Schauer is here drinking coffee, ready to go.
So that brings us to the next question, are we coming out of the recession? Well, let's look at some of those data sets that I've alluded to. To orient ourselves, the blue line is gross domestic product. All of these metrics, we're looking at percent change. It's quarterly data, but over the year, percent change. Blue line, gross domestic product. Green line, wages, total wages. And blue line, personal income. Personal income is 2/3 wages and self-employment income, what people earn from work. The other third is a mix of something called transfer payments. That's payments from the government or payments that come from the government or other sources. In Alaska, the permanent fund dividend is classified as a transfer payment. And then the other category is the one that I mentioned earlier, dividends, interest and rent, it's investment income. So personal income is a broader category of income than just wages, but wages is part of personal income. And what you see here that I want to guide your eyes towards is the all three measures are growing faster than inflation. And this data only goes through quarter three of 2018. That's as limited as we are, that there's no more current data than that. There's no reason to think that the direction of the, and you can, there's not much reason to think the direction of those would have changed in the last quarter or two. So all of those things directionally suggest our economy is recovering. Job growth, whether it's happened or is about to happen, is likely coming soon. All of the things being equal, of course.
Senator Von Imhoff and Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Could you just discuss gross domestic product and what factors are used to calculate that, please?
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff. I meant to do that. So gross domestic product is the value of all the goods and services produced in the state. That doesn't mean all of that value or even any of that value stays in the state. So this is the value, the market value of our oil, our fish, our gold, our zinc, all of those things. It's also the value of the services we produce, so that's wages. The broadest measure of what economic activity is tied to the state, is produced by the state. And then, Senator Von Imhoff, there was a second part to your question that I can't recall.
No, I think that was it. It was, through the chair. There was a big drop, of course, in 2015. I'm assuming that's the price of oil, so the total value of the oil being produced at the time, because I think volume relatively stayed consistent. It's going back up now in 2017-18, the price of oil, I believe. I'm guessing at this point the large drop was due to oil prices. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that is correct. And that's one of the reasons we don't do a lot with gross domestic product, because in Alaska, oil prices, and you're right, more so than production in recent years, really bully the numbers. So we didn't have an economy that contracted by 15% in 2009 when oil prices plunged. We didn't have an economy that contracted by 10% when oil prices dropped as much as they did over that period. And as you can see, the relationship between personal domestic or gross domestic product and wages and personal income is a little, it's not very tight. So they're related to a degree, but different factors. And the main point is really that not all of that value stays in Alaska. And you don't have to think too hard about that, right? That there are shareholders of ConocoPhillips, there are corporate officers of seafood product processing companies. But thank you for that question. It's an important clarification.
I mean, just to help some folks at home, that, as I recall, when we had the oil price dip, the gross value went to about $8 billion. And at the height of the oil peak, price-wise, a few years ago, the gross value was roughly $22 billion. So we have a swing of from 8 to 22. Now we're somewhere around 11. So it is definitely the tail wagging the dog on this one. So it was a good question by Senator von Imhoff to point that out. It's not the matrix, I think, to get too concerned about, relatively speaking, with the other two, wages and personal income.
I agree. And even, I mean, I looked in, not sure what year it was, 2012, maybe, the category that includes oil was a third of our gross domestic product, a third. A few years later, it's a tenth. So it just swings wildly. Sometimes we look at gross domestic product subtracting out oil. And then you get some interesting insights into our economy, what other sectors are doing what. But if oil is included, oil is what's going to drive those numbers. This slide.
Hold it before you start there. We've got a question from Senator Machiki.
Yeah, back when this would be an interesting slide to see if you extended it to the mid-80s and overlaid out migration on this slide as well. But the question, you know, we're unique. I see the states you lump us with, right? The lack of economic diversification. Obviously, we take a big hit on oil price impacts when that occurs. But a couple of slides back, you talked about our recession largely being self-inflicted. But you also said, you made the statement about whether or not we took care of it or would take care of it that could change that self-infliction. And here we are climbing out. Unique tensions with the PFD and other issues, but did the POM, did we do something? Did we take care of something? Did the POMV perhaps help with the change? Or because oil prices are relatively stagnant in the 60s, which I think in today's market is probably not low, but certainly not high. What did we do to take care of it that you would say attributes the increase or the improvement?
Senator Machiki, through the chair, decoupling the question a little bit, whether it's what improved it, we did do something, and we did something, and we wrote about this in, the February issue of our publication. We did something very important with the POMV change. We created a new revenue stream that isn't directly tied to oil. That revenue stream, as you know better than I do, is tied to the ability of the permanent fund folks to invest wisely. So we're tied now to the national and international economies. That's different than the oil revenue generated in Alaska. That was a very big, important step. So that gets us partway there.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
This slide looks at our 2019 forecast. The details of this are less the point this morning than the butt up at the top. We did this work in October, November, December. We released it in January. Of course, the budget was released in early February. When we did all of this work, there was no talk yet of a $1.6 billion budget cut. So part of the chronology is important here. I wouldn't want somebody to say, well, look, the Department of Labor says everything's going to be fine in 2019, despite the whatever happens with this budget in the next period. That was not part of our thinking when we did this forecast. And moving to the next slide, forecasting employment is much easier than forecasting oil prices and forecasting a lot of other things because it moves within a narrower range. But we are able to most of the time look ahead that limited amount and see what will happen. We have a pretty good record, and one of the pretty good. I don't want to break my arm patting ourselves on the back, but it's when we dipped below zero in 2009, for example, we've been growing for 20 plus years. So it's not obvious when you're going to go from growth to not growing. But the two times that we've done that over this period, we've identified that in our forecast. You can see that there are plenty of times we've missed by amounts that we then do some postmortem and try to figure out what did we not see, should we have seen it, those kinds of things. Jumping ahead to the lines in our forecast that would very definitely have changed if this conversation was happening when we were doing our forecast, you see, for example, some of these are just summary cells, but you see, starting at the bottom, local government, our forecast would have been different. Even if this conversation was happening, even not knowing how it's going to finish, state government, we wouldn't have forecasted minus 200 jobs. Healthcare, retail trade, leisure and hospitality, not so much the tourism side of that, but the consumer spending side, the part that's driven by Alaskans going out to eat in restaurants. And then, of course, that changes the total government, the total private sector, the total non-farm employment numbers. The other point I wanted to make with this slide is there are a handful of sectors that would not have changed very much if we had known in October, November, and December that there was a possibility of a budget cut of this magnitude. What's going to happen with oil and gas in 2019, relatively unaffected by what happens in this budget session. And we could quibble about that. But military spending in Fairbanks is probably a better example in the Fairbanks area. The missile defense investment, the F-35 squadrons, that's going to happen however this budget shakes out. The big increase in tourism visitors to Alaska in this summer, that's going to happen no matter how this budget issue shakes out. So there's a mix of things that would have changed and a mix of things that would not have changed.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. ICER has told us over the years that about 1,086 jobs are lost for every $100 million in budget cuts. Is that a number that you agree with?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it's far wiser for ICER to speak for ICER. We're going to look at a slide in a few minutes at the way we approach that is less from a modeling perspective than from a historical pattern perspective. I have a ton of respect for the three economists who did that study, and I wouldn't presume to understand it even well enough to say it's right or it's wrong. So I'll leave it at that.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, just trying to get some kind of estimate from you how much of an impact to the jobs in Alaska, a $1.6 billion, I guess it's a $1.1 billion budget cut would have.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, your amendment at the end is interesting to me because when I heard David Teal talk, it caught my attention that may have made maybe it's $600 million in operations spending. So we don't begin, and when we were contacted about doing this presentation, I started to think through how would we change our 2019 forecast specifically in response to this. We don't begin to understand the details of it well enough to even take a rough stab. We could start to compartmentalize the changes. Healthcare, for example, universities, probably the cleanest example. What does a cut of, I'm not even sure off the top of my head what the numbers for the university mean. Well, it depends, obviously, whether they cut jobs or they cut spending. K-12 might be a better example. One possibility is they cut teachers. Another possibility is they eliminate all activity-related travel. Think how much difference that makes in terms of the employment impact. So we don't begin to understand the details well enough to dive into that yet.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
related to that point, it's always interesting to us when we can find a historical analogy that has an interesting similarity. So, and we have one, and we have others too. This is an issue we've looked at over the years to see what kind of an impact the dividend has on employment specifically. This chart is a little, let's get our bearings a little bit. 2007 is the blue line, 2008 is the red line. This is employment by month over those 2 years. In 2007, we had a permanent fund dividend of about $1,600. In 2008, the dividend was $2,000 plus the $1,200 resource rebate. Diesel fuel prices were very high. There was that oil revenue was very high, but individual Alaskans were paying, especially in rural Alaska, very high fuel costs. So that all precipitated this additional dividend distribution. And what you see is, that was announced in August, or maybe the legislation passed in August, the specifics were announced in September, and then the dividend went out as usual in October. And what you see here on this chart is no discernible impact on total non-farm employment. That at first surprises us a little bit, but if you think about it, how might have Alaskans have spent that additional $1,600 from what they got the previous year? Well, a lot of them probably spent it on fuel costs. Some of them might have saved it for their kids' savings account. Lots of things. The question is, how much of this money makes it into the economy? How much of that spending happens in Alaska? And then how much of that creates jobs? If Alaskans buy, if they go out to eat more often, or if they pay down a credit card, none of those things in themselves create employment, which is really important to note. That doesn't mean it doesn't create an economic boost to the state. When you add $1.1 billion to Alaskans' pockets, that's an economic stimulus. Whether it creates job growth, big enough to see in these big numbers, it didn't. Zooming in a little bit to an industry still looking for a discernible impact, there are things we can see: the earthquake, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, Medicaid expansion. There are things that are big enough they do show up in these big numbers. This is as close as we found to a specific employment boost, and this is again a little bit art and a little bit science. So on this chart, this is retail trade employment by month, same time period, same colored lines. But you see that in 2000, as we get towards the summer, 2008 starts to dip below 2007. We're just starting to be affected by the U.S. rate recession. And then the dividend comes out in October, pops up a little bit. So there was probably some retail spending that created some retail employment growth. And then fairly soon we're back to the previous relationship. Part of this, returning to Senator Wilkowski's point, one, these things are hard to measure. Two, long-term versus short-term matters an awful lot. And three, really, modeling it requires simplification. And good modelers, and Lucene is definitely a good modeler, takes into account what's happened historically. And this is just, it's a case study. This is one time period. All time periods are different. Always lots of things happening in an economy.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So you're looking at 2007, 2008, and you're looking at a year based on a decade of, I'm sure, data that you've looked at. What, in your opinion, would change if we paid the dividend out in four equal installments over the year, four quarterly payments of smaller payments versus one big lump sum in October?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, it's a good question. Our dividend has been studied a little bit as a possible example of universal basic income. Scott Goldsmith of ICER did that work. The reasons, and I'm summarizing a little bit here from memory, that it doesn't really fit the criteria is because it's not frequent enough. It only happens once a year, and it's not certain enough. And then another one is probably that it's not big enough. to meet the criteria for universal basic income. But broadly, to your point, making it quarterly would likely change the spending patterns of Alaskans who receive it. But there really hasn't been a lot of study on how it's spent. And the studies that have been done suggest it makes Alaskans richer. It's not spent to a high degree right away in Alaska.
Senator Bishop.
I promised your staff I'd be easy. Mr. Robinson, it's always a pleasure to hear you present. And therein lies, with your last comment, and I just have a comment, the $64 billion question. It'd be nice someday to do an analytical dive on where the money goes.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
That's my last slide, so I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Well, let's back up a little bit. Senator Bishop was expressing some interest in an analytical analysis on where the dividend goes and the impacts of. Have you guys thought about that or interested in that? Or
through the chair, it's interesting to think through how that could be done. The most obvious way is to survey Alaskans. Would they be forthcoming? There are costs to survey, and one distinction to draw, there are data sources that come from administrative records, permanent fund dividend example, these wage records that are really rich in terms of understanding who's working, how much they're making. Those exist because employers are required to file them under state unemployment insurance laws. There's no administrative data set that would easily track how Alaskans spend their dividend. Sales taxes, if we had a statewide sales tax, would be one possible avenue. We don't. We could look at the parts of the state that do have sales taxes. So that would be highly valuable, but it wouldn't be quick, it wouldn't be inexpensive, and there'd be some questions about how willing Alaskans would be to respond to that kind of.
Do we have any final questions for Mr. Robinson before we go to our second presenter? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can we revert to slide 7, please? And I just want the committee to recall the presentation by President Johnson during this same period from 15 through 18. The University of Alaska is one of the largest employers in the state of Alaska. They directly support an average of 7,500 jobs with an annual wage of close to $350 million. When jobs indirectly or directly linked to the university are considered, the university supports some 15,800 jobs and a total wage of $630 million in wages. I think if the committee can recall, the budget of the university was close to a 40% reduction. And I would assume that when you're looking at this slide, even though we don't have what the Board of Regents would do in regards to positions or what they would do with such a massive cut, I would assume that the number, when you look at the numbers and the magnitude of the jobs that the University of Alaska provide, one of the biggest numbers in the university's budget are jobs, and I would assume with the numbers that we're looking at in direct and indirect jobs of 15,000, I would assume that the percentages of wages would be even higher. So with that, I would say that is it not conceivable that number, if all the departments were equal, would have Alaska going even further south than what you have on slide 7 in job reductions?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I think that goes back to the details of how all of the cuts would be enacted. We've seen losses to university jobs already, along with state government jobs. You could look at the relationship between university spending and their jobs and get some sense of how many additional jobs would be likely. But for us, at least, we don't begin to have the details enough, and I don't think anybody does, but even to quantify the cuts to the university, to try to tie that to jobs, it's early for us to have any thoughts on that.
But wouldn't you say that a 41% reduction in the university's budget would have substantial impact on the economy of the state of Alaska, considering that they are one of the largest employers?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, to the slide that showed our 2019 forecast, if we knew that cut was happening, our state government employment forecast would have been much larger in the negative, for certain.
Well, we don't know that that is going to happen, but we do know that that is what is being proposed by the Dunleavy administration.
Senator Walkowski.
Yeah, just slide 18, just a request. You've indicated that the proposed budget would change the forecast. Could you provide us with the changed forecast under the proposed budget?
Senator Walkowski, through the chair, we have never done that. It's a little bit like revenue sources book. There's a lot of time and effort that goes into producing this. We'll be thinking about that in anticipation of our 2020 forecast. So we'd be glad to talk about what we could do, but producing a new forecast in the short term is unlikely.
So your department is a look back. Right? Isn't that what you said in the beginning of your presentation?
Chair Stedman, for the most part, although this is a look forward, and we look forward for long-term population projections, and we look forward 10 years for occupational projections so that the workforce development community and the university can know where the jobs are going to be. But there's a lot of, it's not economic modeling, it's trend analysis, and it's digging into the details of the specific employers even. So it's not a small ask. We can talk more depending on.
I think the next presenter is a look forward and some other issues, and then there's other entities that could do the look forward and does look more of the look forward analysis. Other questions for the presenter? Senator Michicki.
Thank you. We didn't talk about this a lot. We sort of kind of nibbled around the edges, but certainly when on slide 15 where you show that perhaps we did some things to pull out of this recession. I think one of them, Senate Bill 21, and I think one of them is Senate Bill 26, right? You've got additional investment on the North Slope. With the POMV, folks are feeling a little bit more comfortable that primary investors in the state won't be the target because there's a new revenue stream. This budget and the fact that it's, for some, it's easier to hit or tax any kind of industry than your individual constituents, don't you see, or do you see a significant destabilization that could potentially put us right back in that across-the-board uncertainty that could cause an additional, redirect that upward trend back in the other direction?
Senator Michicki, through the chair, we pay a fair amount of attention to what you do here, but most of our attention is on what the industry does and when. People tend to exaggerate the fragility of an economy. So when people say, for example, that a tax would be poisonous to an economy, that's depends on the size of the tax. When people say that the dividend would be magic for an economy, well, let's look at that and see the specifics of what a dividend does. We talk about using savings. Where does that money come from? What does it do for us long term if it's gone? Those are the I think central questions, and they very quickly become non-economic questions. They become policy preference questions. Do you want to have a state with low taxes and fewer services and a dividend? Or you're familiar with the three or four primary options. But they're not economic questions, and people shouldn't worry as much as I think they do about the fragility of economies. Uncertainty is a real factor, but things don't spiral down fast, as we've seen from our historical numbers, or spiral up fast.
Well, I'm not sure we got at the so again, we had some relative stability. Things seem to uptick. Do you not feel that a 36%, I mean, most of us want to reduce our spend. Most of us want to get closer to a balanced budget or get to a balanced budget over time. Do you not see a 30% reduction of state spend sending a signal to industry that perhaps they may be the next one with a target on their back? Do you not see that as having an impact on investment in the state?
Well, Senator Michicki, through the chair, I think the way we would look at it for where we are now is it's disruptive, right? Even now, even when we don't know what's happening, there's new disruption. There are new questions about what's going to happen. There are costs to that, similar to nationally, tariffs, for example, that creates a disruption. Whether or not it's worth it, right, whether or not it's worth it to have this conversation long term, again, becomes a political question, to define what kind of a state we want to have. But to the extent it's an economic question, there's no doubt that a budget cut, and even a conversation about the possibility of a budget cut of this magnitude, creates new short-term uncertainty. And that has economic costs.
So just to make it simple so I understand it, it's not an economic stimulus, it's an economic retardant.
Chair Stedman, I think that's accurate, that we'll have this headwind until we get this structural change behind us. We might grow, but we'll grow less than we would. Wyoming and North Dakota, they're kind of back to normal. They're back to their pre-oil price normal. They didn't have to sort through this as a response to what happened to oil prices.
Thank you. That concludes the first presentation. We'll gear up here for the second one. We'll ask Mr. Ed King to come forward, Chief Economist for the Office of Management and Budget. And if we don't conclude with Mr. King today at our allotted time, we will run him over, finish him up tomorrow. Mr. King, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I brought backup.
Got it right there in your hand. So if you could introduce yourself for the record, I've told Mr. King he could have all the lifelines he needed, but apparently he's got them right alongside of him for day one. So I expect this conversation to maybe get a little lively, so I'd just like to remind everybody to, we want to keep the decorum at the table, be polite to our presenters. We can ask them tough questions, and they'll give us answers the best they can, but we want to make sure they're not, we give them the due respect that they deserve here as guests of the Finance Committee. But I'm sure we're going to have some interesting conversation as we go forward with that. Mr. King, if you want to introduce yourself, and then for the record, I know you've got your boss with you and Commissioner on the other side, but you're in the middle, and so we'll start with you, and then we'll go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Ed King, Chief Economist, State of Alaska.
Donna Arthur, Director of All of
You. And Bruce Tangeman, Department of Revenue. Just a quick comment, Mr. Chairman. This is obviously, we've got about 45 minutes left. We're not going to solve this problem in 45 minutes. We're not going to try and get any bumper sticker statements out of this. I see this as we'll have several meetings, hopefully, on this topic, because it is a really, really big issue, and it can't be solved in 45 minutes. We look forward to being back in front of you several other times.
Right. We'll walk through the slides, and then we'll see at the end. Be nice to, if we don't get done, to, which is unlikely, but to finish it up so we kind of stay on track. As we go forward, because we're putting these presentations, kind of packaging them together for the public so they can follow along with what we're doing and understand these decisions that we have to make to move our economy forward. Mr. King, you want to go ahead and start your presentation, please?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. And just, I don't mind questioning. I don't mind jumping around, moving between slides, whatever pleases the committee. I'm happy to accommodate however I can. I would like to inform you that I did bring both my hands today, so I apologize for that. But you probably won't get as clear of answers as you would like to, and I'm sorry. That's the nature of my job. I'd also, just as an opening comment, reiterate a comment that Mr. Robinson was making as well, that when we talk about macroeconomic impacts, what we're talking about are statewide impacts, and that there's a difference between what we see as a state economy versus what we see as individuals, the impacts to individuals that live and work within the economy. So when we're talking about statewide impacts, we're talking about impacts to Alaska, not necessarily Alaskans. And I just want to reiterate that fact, that if one person loses a job and another person gains it, from a macroeconomic perspective, that might look like a wash, but from a microeconomic perspective, that has very different impacts on those individuals. I'd also like to point out that there's a difference between economic impacts versus impacts to social well-being, and I think that that's an important conversation that we should be had as well, and that distinction is really important, and I hope that people don't misinterpret some of the statements that I might make as one versus the other. So, Mr. Chairman, just moving to the first slide, I thought the first thing I'd like to do is kind of tackle the moose in the corner, Institute of Social and Economic Reports research report that is the short-run economic impacts of Alaska fiscal options, which was published in 2016 by three of my friends over there at ICER and colleagues, people I have great respect for. I know that this report has become very popular in the last few weeks, and I just wanted to make sure that people that are using the numbers that are in this report understand what those numbers mean and how to interpret them correctly. And of course, Dr. Gutabi, when he's here tomorrow, he can reiterate some of these points or clarify some of the points that he feels that I misrepresent, but I just want to make sure that people understand how an impact analysis works and what it actually means. And in order to do that, I'm moving to slide 3. This is just an illustrative graphic that kind of shows how money moves through an economy and what that economic impact means when we say, 10,000 jobs or whatever the job number is that you want to throw around. So when you think about an economy and how it functions, if you think about, we'll take an example, and I'm just using a 10x multiplier. Alaska does not have a 10x multiplier. This is just for illustration so that people can understand the point. If you take $1,000 and you inject it into somebody's household, or $1 billion and you inject it into the economy, that very first injection of cash gets counted as household income. It gets counted the first time. And then when that person goes out and spends that money at the store, at the movie theater, at the bar, wherever they go, it ends up on the balance sheet, on the cash flow statement of the business that they're purchasing it from. And that business has to go and spend that money in different ways up the supply chain, whether they're buying their goods from other wholesalers or whether they're paying their staff and their workers. That money gets distributed out into the economy as increases in income to all of the people that are participating in that initial injection. And that process continues over time. So as you're moving through time, you're seeing that money move through the economy. So the initial injection goes away and it gets replaced by that secondary effect. And then that secondary effect goes away and gets replaced by a tertiary effect. And if you look over all time and you add up all of those impacts, that's what we're talking about when we talk about an impact analysis. What we are not talking about is what is the impact going to be next year. We're talking about all of the impacts over all time, and that might take decades before that economic activity ripples through the economy. So we should not misinterpret what that job number or that household income number means. It's not a prediction of how the economy will change next year. It's an impact analysis, a computer-simulated model that generates an output over all of the impacts over all time. And if that economic stimulus is repeated time and time again over time periods, then you're going to start seeing those compounding effects, and the market, the economy, will eventually gravitate towards whatever that multiplier is. In this case, it's a 10x multiplier. That just means that 90% of the money stays in the economy, 10% of the money leaves. Of course, every economy has a different multiplier, and Alaska's economy has a very small multiplier because we put so much money on barges to get a product up to Alaska. So a lot of our money is leaking out of the economy. Our multiplier is much, much smaller. So this is just illustrative. But it does kind of point to some of those ideas that are in that report, that and making sure that we understand what those reports really do mean. Another point that I would like to make, and this graphic kind of helps illustrate, is that when you do put an injection into the economy through government spending, if you do this kind of stimulus activity, then that does generate additional economic activity. But as soon as you stop that spending, it creates economic contraction, right? So as soon as you increase spending through government spending, you're trapped. You have to continue that spending, otherwise it's going to trigger a recession. And so that spending trap is very, very important to think about as you're introducing new programs and new spending. That's not a one-time, if you're thinking about it in terms of, I want to help get out of this recession, so I'm just going to inject money into the economy once and then stop, that's different than if you're creating a program that creates a structural change, because you'll never be able to justify ending that program from the basis of jobs and household income. It's a trap. And it doesn't mean that that spending isn't worthwhile, that it isn't creating value, but it does mean that you will see the negative impacts as soon as you stop that spending. And then the third point that I would like to make is that this is looking at it from one perspective. This is an injection into the economy. And you have to ask the question, okay, where is that money coming from? And if that money is coming from the sideline and you're just injecting it into the economy, then great, you have economic growth. But if that money is coming from other people's pockets, it has a negative effect that you have to account for as well. So it's kind of like trying to fill up your swimming pool by taking a bucket full of water out of one end and pouring it into the other. Not going to be very effective. You're going to move water molecules around, but you're not going to fill the pool up. So you have to really consider both the injection and the depletion effects in concert. You can't just look at one or the other. And I can move on, unless there's questions, Mr. Chairman. So along those same lines, Mr. Chairman, the report that we're talking about, as I was saying, you have to look at all of the different effects in concert. So you can't just look at, well, what is the impact of a budget cut? You have to say, okay, well, where's that budget cut coming from? And in this case, what we're saying is, if you want to increase, using the ICER numbers, if you want to increase the budget by $100 million over what the proposed is, you have to answer the question, where's that $100 million coming from? And if it's coming from PFDs, then you also need to consider the negative effect on the economy of those PFDs that aren't being injected into the economy. And I'm not saying that those numbers are right. Mr. Robinson was just talking about how those PFD numbers, you know, may be a little bit different in reality than in what this is saying. I'm just saying, if you do want to use the numbers that are in this ICER report, make sure that you're using them correctly. You can't compare a budget cut to a fictitious world where we can maintain the budget and not have any negative consequences from anywhere. It has to come from somewhere. So just a couple of comments, Mr. Chairman, on that report. If there are some, I'm happy to answer questions at any point along the way. But just some comments on that report. It's a great report. It's a great piece of academic literature. It's very valuable in what it's doing. I just want to make sure that people aren't using those numbers incorrectly. And one of those things that I see people talking about and using incorrectly may be the way that they talk about the job numbers. And I think it's very important that there are different definitions of what a job is, and that it's very important to remember that not all jobs are equal, not in terms of societal value, not in terms of economic impact. All jobs are not equal.
I have a brief ideas. We have a line that dropped sometime in here. We went back to the old copper line. Maybe it had corrosion, I don't know.
Submarine cable got cut.
Everything's getting cut. Ready? Okay, here we go.
Okay, come back on the record. Sorry for the delay. It's just, we have, for those at home, we have a momentary drops in our communication line here. So we'll just take brief at ease when that does happen and rectify it. But go ahead, Mr. King, and continue.
So, Mr. Chairman, as I was talking about, the job numbers are really important. And when somebody talks about jobs, I think it's important to get a definition of what they mean by jobs. In some cases, a part-time job counts as a job. In some cases, a seasonal job that only lasts for 3 months counts as a quarter of a job. In some cases, you add up all of the hours that are worked and divide it by 2,080, and you call that a job. And so when we're talking about job numbers, and you're talking about, you know, a $100,000 job on the North Slope versus a part-time job in a retail store that's paying minimum wage, if you're only looking at job numbers, those would wash. And it's probably not the case that those two jobs have the same impact on the economy or on the person's lives. So it's very misleading when we only look at job numbers. And it's more accurate to look at things like wage numbers or look at GDP or look at some of these other macroeconomic indicators that generate comparisons over time. And again, one person that's losing a job is going to be more impacted by another person that's gaining a job in different ways. So I'm not saying that they are equal, and I don't think anybody should suggest that those are equal. So just be really careful as you're making those comparisons. And then make sure as you're using these numbers that you're making realistic comparisons. It would not be accurate to compare government spending cuts versus last year's government spending, and then compare this year's projected PFD versus last year's PFD. That's an artificial comparison. What you need to compare is, what does 2020 look like under one solution to this problem versus what does 2020 look like under another solution to this problem? But it has to be a solution. It can't be some fantasy solution where you have everything that you want and there's no negative consequence. And then remember again that those numbers that are in the report represent numbers, total impacts over time, and they don't necessarily translate to actual impacts in the data. And you saw that a little bit in the previous presentation as well. Again, another point, Mr. Chairman, is that that ceteris paribus assumption that we use in economics for academic literature, when we hold everything constant and then just turn one knob and see how that one change ripples through the economy without considering how everything else is moving, that's not how a real economy works. And so you shouldn't expect that the outputs of that computer model simulate what an actual impact to the real economy will look like. In reality, when somebody loses their job, they're not just plucked out of the economy and their income is gone from the economy. They go out, they find another job, or they find ways to spend money out of savings, or they adjust in some other way, whether it's through retirement or opening a business. They react to that loss of income by replacing that income. So pulling that money out of the economy, like what the static model will do, doesn't necessarily reflect what happens in reality. And Mr. Chairman, I would just point out that that isn't just me that's saying that. The ICER report in part 3, page 11, says the estimates do not account for potential behavioral adjustments in spending, wage rates, prices, or migration to and from Alaska. The best way to interpret our estimates is the impacts resulting from less money circulating in the economy, but not those that might result from people changing their behavior if their economic circumstances change. That's directly from the report.
For those at home, we're going to have the folks from ICER here tomorrow, so that these two meetings will link together, and we can go into more detail with their study and comments also, and committee members might have follow-up questions from this presentation for ICER also. Go ahead and continue, Mr. King.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, I have a lot of respect for ICER, and I have a lot of respect for the work that they did. I don't intend to discredit it in any way. I just want to make sure that people are understanding what it says. And there is a lot of value in what it does say. But I would point out, and ICER actually, in their report, they also say this, we are more confident in our estimates of the relative impacts of the different options than in their total economic impacts. And I think that that's really important to consider, because we don't use models to predict the future. We use models to understand how the future can change when assumptions change. So all models are always simplifications of reality. That's the definition of a model, right, as a scaled down version of something. So all models are intended to provide insight, but not necessarily instruction. They're not predictive of what will happen. They're instructive on the magnitudes of changes, but not necessarily predictive of exactly how those changes will occur. And one more just from that report, Mr. Chairman, on page three, on section three, page 10, this is the last quote that I'll take from that report. It says, the positive effects of one factor may be offsetting negative effects in the others. And I think that's really important in understanding that the numbers that we're talking about in this report are not predictive of what will actually happen. So I'll just reiterate that one more time. I'll put that aside. And Mr. Chairman, there is some really good information that is in that report, especially around, you know, how dealing with the different the problems that are in front of you, how those different options compare to one another. There's very valuable information in there that we should take into account. And there's very valuable information about the distributional effects on which options impact different regions and different groups differently. And those are things that really should be considered. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll move on to the next slide. So for the public, Mr. Chairman, I just want to reiterate the fact that this problem that we're trying to face, that we're all trying to face, that you all are trying to solve here, and that the governor put a proposal forward which does solve the problem, that problem is not a one-year problem. It is a multi-year. It's into perpetuity as far as we can tell for now. There is no expectation that oil prices are going to recover for a sustained period of time such that our budget problems go away. Now, maybe there will be times in the next decade or two where oil prices spike and temporarily solve our problems. But the status quo projection is that we have a multi-billion dollar deficit that needs to be addressed. And that's going to require a structural change in some form or fashion. It isn't just something that we can nibble around the edges at. It isn't something that we just need to get through this year and then we'll be okay. This is a real problem that requires a real solution.
Before we go to the next slide, are you done with this slide?
I have a question.
Well, you can go first if you want.
Thank you,
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you agree or disagree that we solved 80% of the problem last year when we passed SB 26?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop. So there, part of the problem is solved by taking that draw out of that savings account. That is true. That is a way that we can solve about half of this problem, right? It's a a little bit more than $2 billion problem altogether. That solves about $1 billion of it. And if you want, I'll move to the next slide to continue that point as I answer your question.
We'll just, let's keep the slides in order, and if you want to answer part of a question with the further slides down the deck, we'll wait until we have the proper slide, or we'll be jumping all over the slide deck. So you can give him a brief answer, and then we'll continue on. He's got a follow-up also.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with you, with the chair, not jumping around the slides. You answered my question. We're just difference of opinion on 30%.
Okay. So if I could, I'm a little confused on this slide, where we got the dotted line running up and down for FY19. I think we had about we're looking at this current fiscal year for those at home that ends end of June. We're expecting roughly a $300 million deficit. We were initially expecting about a 600, but we've got a little more revenue and have a few other favorable issues. So we'll be basically underwater, around 300 million.
Mr. Chairman.
But I'll give my question out there. No, we can, you can jump on board if you want. So the current year we're talking about, the FY20, we're talking about a $1.6 billion deficit if we pay out a $3,000 dividend. And I see your red lines are almost equal between FY19 and FY20, so I'm a little curious about that. But it, it seems like the 1.6 is definitely hinged on the size of the dividend. So it's kind of a two-part question. So help me with the comparison of those two red bars right on the right-hand side of the dotted line, and then with the definitional difference between one view and another view depending on the size of the dividend.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So to answer your question, the numbers on this slide represent the unrestricted general fund expenditures versus the unrestricted general fund revenues. So that's your oil tax revenues, that's all of your oil revenues, which is about 1.2, and then you have another, or a little bit more than that, you have about 2.2, and then you have a little bit of additional revenues from non-oil and gas activities. So your UGF revenue minus your expected, your FY19 10-year plan really is what this number you're coming from. If you tried to pay that, if you tried to follow that plan, that expenditure plan, with the revenues that are being generated by the state, and not including the permanent fund revenues that are other revenues, not UGF revenues, those are savings account revenues that are sitting in the UGF, that are sitting in the earnings reserve. If you use some of those revenues, those non-UGF revenues, to satisfy some of those UGF expenditure requirements, then yes, that is the way that you're closing this gap. And the rest of the gap for FY19 is being closed by a spend from a different savings account, the CBR. And so when I put these numbers together, what I'm talking about is this is a deficit, revenues minus expenditures, and then you have to fill that deficit somehow. One of the ways that you can fill that deficit is by spending out of savings, and the ERA is a savings account. Whether we call it a percentage of market value draw or whether we call it some other thing, it's still a draw from a savings account.
Okay, so let's be careful when we use the acronyms for those watching that aren't as familiar with what an SBR is and a CBR and a UGF. So maybe you can tell us what a UGF is and why we should even care. Have an interest in.
Right, Mr. Chairman, the unrestricted general fund is the kind of discretionary funding that the legislature has. So you have your designated general funds, which are programs that generate their own revenues and that you spend those revenues for the operations of those programs. You have other types of revenues and expenditures that happen from federal government or from other accounts. The unrestricted general fund is kind of the discretionary account, the checking account, if you will, of the state. And so what we're talking about is, you know, when you're writing a check out of that checking account versus what the income looks like into that checking account. And one way that you can deal with, you know, balancing that checkbook is by making a transfer from a savings account. And that's what I was talking about. Right now, the status quo is that we have multi-billion dollar deficits. That is our checks that we're trying to write, we can't cover them with the income that we're generating.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Following along those same lines that the chairman has been referring to and Senate Bill 26, as I assume that Senate Bill 26, you're assuming that is status quo and the draw of $3 billion from the ERA?
So let's define what Senate Bill 26 is. Some of us are familiar with it.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, so the Senate Bill 26, and I'm happy to explain it, or if you'd like to explain it to the public either.
You could briefly explain it.
Senate Bill 26 passed last year. It gives permission for the legislature to transfer money from the earnings reserve of the permanent fund to the unrestricted the general fund of the state, so that they can use it to cover the expenditures, so that you all can use it to cover the expenditures that you feel like the state needs to expend. The requirement in that statute is that the transfer cannot exceed, for this next fiscal year, 5.25% of the lagging five-year rolling average of the balance of the permanent fund. Moving forward, that will be reduced to 5% starting in 2021. So that is the maximum allowable transfer from the earnings reserve to the general fund under that statute.
And then for Senator Bethel's question.
And my question is this, under the status quo, is that, are you assuming that the dividend is $1,600 per year?
So through the chair, Senator Hoffman, in this graph right here, the permanent fund dividend is not a unrestricted general fund expenditure. It is a off-book transfer from the earnings reserve to the dividend fund.
And I guess the problem that I have is that when you talk about the governor's proposal fixing the problem, he ties the legislature's hands if we can't consider several things like additional income and other allocations. It seems as though we as a legislature need to consider those. I know he said we could look at other options, and I think that is what this legislature has been trying to do these last 2 months. What are the other options that are available to us? But it seems as though when we have presentations such as this, we are not being given those options when we're requesting them of the administration, which seems to me that our hands are tied behind our backs.
Seems like that's not a question for Mr. King. If one of the other lifeliners want to help that question, please.
I'll start, Mr. Chairman. Bruce Tangeman, Department of Revenue. You're correct, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman. What the governor presented was his solution. He fully expects the legislature to engage and come up with their own ideas and solutions to the problem. I think we all can agree there's a problem, at least. We can also all agree that we don't have that many knobs to turn to solve that problem. UGF revenue, oil revenue, price, production, the POMB draw itself are fairly stable items for us right now. So obviously the elephant in the room is the permanent fund dividend itself and the expenditure side of the equation. So those are really the two issues that are drawing the most attention this time around, and he fully expects ideas to come from this body. So it's not a take it or leave it, I don't believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's good to hear. It's not a take it or leave it. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So we were on slide 7, and I kind of flipped through the remaining slides, and I actually thought that this was going to be an economic analysis and impact in some of the reductions that the administration had proposed. The university, we've got community campus ideas, four-year college research. How does that translate into an economic impact across the state? Department of Education, a $1,000 decrease in the BSA, how is that going to ripple effect? Medicaid, what are the economic impacts on rural hospitals, trauma hospitals, elder care with the Pioneer Homes? The ferry, Southeast Alaska, how much can a full PFD offset the loss of ferry service in Southeast? I don't know if this economic impact on some of the more, and I wouldn't even call it details, the broader strokes of the budget proposal, is that a later date?
If you could help Senator Von Imhoff with that, please.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I believe they will be at later dates. Again, this is something that we're not going to be able to present and solve in the next 15 minutes, but we do need to set the stage for what the statewide, the general economic situation is for the state before we start diving down into those silos, because they are all quite unique. But you have to set the stage first on where we're at. What are some of the comments that are being spoken of? I know just another big issue that I've heard is, you know, what analysis has been done prior to this budget being introduced. I'll just take that head on, because I don't want the misperception to be put out there, and I know it's not going to come from this body, but I don't want the misperception to be that there's a timestamp on a model sitting somewhere, and every budget decision made after that timestamp is fine and analytical, but every decision made before that timestamp is not fine and not analytical. I went back through the ICER website. They've been producing reports since I saw the first one was by George Rogers in 1962. There's 400 plus reports out there on the economy itself. And there's several really interesting ones over the last 5 years as we started to go into this recession and some of the impacts economic impacts of cuts, of changes to revenue, of taxes, of different things. So I just wanted to make that clear that the decisions that were made, you're not going to find a model that has a date stamp on it, but there is a lot of work that has been done over the last decade on these issues, and this presentation is setting the stage for future presentations as we dive into those silos.
You have a follow-up?
Thank you, Chair Stedman. It is a relief knowing that these economic impact analysis is being conducted, and I'm looking forward to seeing them at this committee. And as a date stamp, I believe June 30th at 5 p.m. is a pretty bright date stamp.
We'll have hopefully the commissioners in front of us when we have those different departments that was mentioned, along with OMB, and support from OMB, and we'll take a look at those in much more detail and be very interested in the pros and cons of budgetary actions that we may take, so we can, as a committee, make the best decision possible. So, as referenced, this presentation's a broader brush, kind of like what we did with the OMB. They gave us a broad brush at 35,000 feet, and then they went down several meetings later by different departments. And then we're going to zero in on the bigger departments and even go deeper. So we're looking forward to working with you guys. But the center, or any other questions from the senators at the table? Okay, go ahead and continue. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to slide number 8. So this slide, Mr. Chairman, is just basically the same as the slide before it. It's showing the problem and the structural nature of that problem. On this slide, though, I am allowing the POMV, the percent of market value, under SB 26 to be included. So the green layer on the top of that background represents the 5.25% draw that's allowed minus the statutory calculated dividend. And what you can see is that even with that SB 26 included, it doesn't quite solve the problem. We still have this $1.6 billion hole to fill this year. We still have that hole's going to get a little bit deeper in the next few years, and it doesn't just go away even as oil prices and production, or mostly oil production, increases over the 2026 to 2028 and beyond time frame. So the problem exists, and it will continue to exist until something changes. And there are many different ways, Mr. Chairman, that we could go about solving this problem. One is to make budget cuts.
We're going to go back to slide 8.
Yes.
Slide 8 is, I think, Senator Bishop had a question dealing. You want to pass?
I'll pass right now because.
So that when putting the slide together, what dividend assumption did you use?
Mr. Chairman, this is the statutory calculation. And it's in the background. The statutory calculated PFD is removed from the percentage of market value, and what is left is that top green layer.
And does it increase or decrease the percentage split of that 5.25% coming out per year?
If I understood your question correctly, I think you're asking if the PFD consumes a larger portion of the POMB. Is that what the question was?
Correct.
Yeah, that is correct, Mr. Chairman. As the fund generates earnings, the PFD gets larger, and that PFD grows faster than the POMV does. Sorry for the acronyms, but which means that your percentage of the percentage market value that's going towards dividends is getting larger over time.
So that would be one extreme where we do the statutory POMV, percent of market value, the statutory calculation for the dividend payout, which is what we're talking about here when we talk about $3,000 dividends. The other extreme would be if we paid no dividend at all. what would this chart look like if we paid no dividend at all? We consumed the entire 5.25% and then down to 5% for operations of the state.
Mr. Chairman, in that scenario, what you would see is that in the first 4 years of this graphic, the total access to cash would meet or exceed the expenditures that are needed. But as the budget grows faster than the POMV grows, you eventually run out of room and you have to do something different. That happens in the 2024-2025 timeframe.
And if you could, Mr. King, bring that restated slide back, or slide, make it 8B, as we continue the presentation in another day. We've got 15 minutes left, but I think this is, for those watching at home, that's where you see a difference in the definition of the deficit, where if you pay a $3,000 dividend, you can something has to give somewhere. If there's no new revenue sources, take the budget reductions, you're basically negative $1.6 billion. If you pay out no dividend, you get a whole different picture, and we can meet our obligations with a very small dividend. So I'd like the committee to see the range that they have to operate within so we can have that policy discussion with the assumption that all statutory requirements are created equal and or will equally contribute to the solution of our budget needs. So if you could restate that, or just add another version so we can see the margin that we're talking about here. We have another question or any other questions on Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. King, as I look at this slide here, and correct me if I'm wrong, it appears that you're starting to with the starting point with the Walker budget that's there and then grows up incrementally depending on the percentages there, but your revenues appear to be the same. Is that, am I interpreting that correctly?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that is correct. That is a product of the price and production forecast, which does not grow at the same rate that inflation impacts the spending profile.
Mr. Chairman, if I can continue. As you look at the $1 billion that are ongoing, the two-thirds of that POMV is going to be going out in dividends. I don't see any consideration for taking into the fact that there may be a stock market correction that's going to severely affect, if not downright devastate, what's going to be happening from there. I guess I'm wondering, my question has to do with what'll happen then, or what'll happen to the permanent fund dividend that everybody's so interested in?
Mr. Chairman, and through the chair, Senator Olson, that is a fantastic question. I actually really enjoy running the different scenarios and seeing how the mechanics kind of adjust. And I would be happy to do a presentation for this committee at a later date. I'm not equipped to do that now, but that is a very relevant and interesting discussion.
So did you use a linear projection of future returns of the permanent fund, or what did you use?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, these are all, everything in this slide is based on publicly available information. So it's the Permanent Fund Corporation's projection of earnings. It's the fiscal year 19 10-year plan for the expenditure profile. It's the RSB's projection, the revenue sources book projection of revenues. Everything is already out there in the public as documents generated by other agencies.
And if I could add one thing to that, sir, through the chair, Senator Olson, we get that question a lot. What would a 2008 scenario look like? What we don't get asked is what does a 2016 or 2017 scenario look like when we were seeing really good returns? So that's the point of using what the permanent fund produces. They use 6.55. They smooth out the plus 20s and they smooth out the minus 8s. So we're not going to cherry pick a plus 20 to make a point, and we're certainly not going to lean on a minus 8 for doom and gloom. But those scenarios are reality, though, and they do affect a short term. But when you look at the 6.55, that's more to smooth out long term averages.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad that you said that options are on the table, but I think the chairman asked for a zero dividend and a full dividend under statutory requirements of a $3,000 dividend. So if we come up with an option that has a dividend that is less than the $3,000 and can balance the budget, potentially using the ERA as a or the CBR, Constitutional Budget Reserve, for a soft landing, that will be acceptable, or is that not acceptable and our hands are tied behind our backs? I'm fully aware of that, and I think that everyone at this table fully understands that. The question that that I heard earlier, though, is that we can look at other options to balance the state's checkbook, and several of those options are using the CBR, which the governor does not use, and looking at the question that the chairman had asked for, a zero dividend or something in between, and if we come up with a plan that does that over time, maybe 2 to 3 years, using the CBR, and show that in 4 to 5 years that we can have a softer landing, is that acceptable to the administration? A smaller dividend and other options, including reductions in budgets.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, again, I think when Mr. King gets through his presentation, you'll start to see how some of those may develop. But to my earlier point, once you have a full budget proposal, Mr. King can analyze it in the same way that he's analyzed the governor's proposal.
Thank you very much for that non-answer.
Mr. King?
I didn't get anything out of the last comment either, Mr. Chairman.
Would say, yeah, we're going to finish up here because we're almost out of time. Senator Olson, you have a question? Well, they're going to stop. You're on slide 8.
I want answers. I don't want gibberish.
Pardon me?
I want answers to the questions, not a rehashing of what's going on.
Well, they'll be back before us tomorrow morning. Maybe they'll have a different answer in the morning after they talk to their boss. Clearly, we're interested in what is obtainable through this process. And for those watching at home, the statutory required dividend, there's a lot of other issues in the proposal that are statutorily controlled that may not be changed by the legislature. And then I assume that all statutory controlled expenditures would be made. Is that not correct, Mr. Revenue Commissioner?
Could you repeat the question, sir?
The dividend is statutorily controlled. I'll give you an example. The fish tax there's several issues within the budget proposal that are statutorily controlled, and there'll be several legislative requests for change the requirements for the administration to make expenditures. So does the administration intend to make all required expenditures that are statutorily required, or treat the dividend different from other statutory requirements?
I'd defer that to the OMB director, since that is a budget discussion.
Ms. Ordwin, do you
have? To the chair, if I understood the question, that once we have a final budget, the governor will live within the statutes and the appropriations that are the final budget.
Okay. Good. With that, we're going to conclude today. I'd like to thank our presenters for warming us up. We'll be back tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. We'll continue with slide 9. Hopefully we'll start with just a quick answer to the previous question by Senator Hoffman on flexibility, if there is any, or none, after they speak to their boss. And then we'll continue on through the higher level overview of the economics of the proposal. And we will probably be pushing back the other presenters tomorrow a little bit. We'll adjust that. We'll talk to them. We have a presentation coming from ICER, and we have a confirmation hearing. And the confirmation hearing, we'll figure out when we're going to slip that in and try to get that out of the way. So we'll work with those two agenda items and then keep it posted and try to keep on schedule. Thanks, everybody, for coming today. We are adjourned.